younger generation of Germans. They would be spared their parents' sins, as Adenauer promised. No one even spoke of the war, the concentration camps, the millions of murders. The parents themselves looked relieved, if skeptical. They were signing their young over to an institution, one that was venerable, sanctified, and thoroughly vetted. But they understood the perils of indoctrination. Even Marianne, for all her bluster, was not immune to doubt. Benita detected strain beneath her show of cheer. All three of her children would now be out of the house. Any mother would feel the smart. Benita, on the other hand, felt oddly empty and cried out. She had resigned herself ages ago to this peculiar aristocratic fate. Her boy, her baby, would be swallowed whole by this austere castle, occupied for centuries by the class of people her own humble peasant family had toiled to serve. He was to be admitted completely into their ranks. This was progress, wasn't it? Even if it created distance between them.
"Here he is,"
Marianne called out to an officious young prefect, pointing at Martin.
"Martin Konstantin Fledermann."
The full name was jarring. Benita never used it.
"Ah,"
the prefect introduced himself in the clipped manner of an ex-Hitler youth.
"Follow me to your quarters,"
he instructed. And for a moment it seemed this would be their goodbye. But then Martin turned and embraced his mother with all the fierceness of a younger child.
"Goodbye, Mama,"
he said, as Benita held him. And the word filled her with happiness. Mama, if nothing else, she had given birth to him. Benita and Marianne were silent on the drive to the inn. Marianne knitted, her needles tapping. She had learned this skill in the last few years from Anya, and approached it as if it were a quaint, mildly entertaining art form, rather than a tiresome matter of necessity, which it had always been in the Gruber household. The inn was shabby, an ugly, half-timbered house with a crooked roof and narrow yellow glass windows on the ground floor.
"I'll have dinner sent up," Marianne announced. "You can join me if you wish."
Benita demurred. She was happy to be left alone. And anyway, she was not hungry. They parted at the bottom of the stairs. But once Benita closed the little slanted door to her room under the eaves and saw the plain wooden cross mounted on the wall, the brown shaded lamp and worn coverlet, she knew she would die if she sat down. So instead, she descended the stairs and walked through the dingy foyer and out onto the street. The inn was located on a narrow pedestrian throughway, and people walked past, shuttling children home to supper, carrying marketing sacks. Benita felt raw and exposed. She was stripped of the love she had wrapped around her like a protective cloak.
No more Franz. No more Martin.
Suddenly she saw everything in its harsh, naked state. She felt the pulse of the lives lived inside the mean little houses she passed. Selfish or generous, kind or unkind, ugly or tolerable. Almost all of them sad. And she saw the histories of the people passing by like X-rays stamped on their faces. Ugly, mutinous tracings of dark and light. A woman who had ratted out a neighbor. A man who had shot children. A soldier who had held his dying friend in his arms.
And here they were,
carrying groceries, holding children's hands, turning their collars up against the wind, as if their moments of truth, the decisions by which they would be judged and would judge themselves, hadn't already come and passed. What a sham this new German present was. An irrelevant time. A mad scramble to cast votes after the verdict had already been reached. From behind the inn's gate, there was the dull thud of a beer stein knocking against another, a clatter and an outburst of scolding. Benita turned her feet toward the noise and discovered a meager Biergarten, behind a stone wall, long, roughly hewn tables arranged over gravel. It was nearly empty. A group of older men sat in the corner. Another group stood at the bar. The heavy smell of stale cigarette smoke hung in the air. Benita sat at the end of an empty table and ordered a schnapps. She thought of her mother, poor, hard-working Ilse Gruber, how she had loved her glass of schnapps before bed. And now she was dead, Vinita had never even said goodbye.
To you, Mama,
she thought as she swallowed the rough, tangy liquid, flinching at the burn. She felt a rush of sadness for her own loss, and for the decidedly unsparkling life of her mother, a woman who had existed entirely outside the reaches of love. And now, she, Benita Gruber, would become just like her. She would return to Frühlinghausen in shame and be consumed by her own roots. Benita finished her first schnapps and ordered another.
The world grew less bleak.
She caught the bartender eyeing her curiously, a middle-aged woman in a proper dress drinking alone.
Did he see some trace of the girl she had once been?
The Benita who Connie had boasted could turn even a blind man's head.
The woman whose smile made Franz Müller blush.
Her knees began to feel watery, and the harsh tragedy of the world was enveloped in a soft, forgiving haze.
The beer garden was filling up.
A small group of teenagers sat at the end of her table.
They were boisterous girls and boys, poor kids,
workers' children. The girls in their new American-style full skirts, but their hair still worn in plain farm girl cuts. A man sat down beside Benita. He was young. A boy, really. And handsome with a particular blooming sort of handsomeness that would not last. Was even now beginning to thicken and dissolve.
Another schnapps for the lady, he called. And a beer for me.
He had the air of a posturing teenager. How amazing that such an impulse could still exist. That a young man could still care enough to pretend to be something he wasn't. And the girls, too.
She saw it suddenly. These young women, self-consciously sipping their beer and lemonades, affecting worldliness.
It was at once horrible and marvelous.
It made her feel 1,000 years old.
What is a beautiful woman like you doing drinking by herself?
The boy asked. His curls poked out from underneath his cap, small and sweaty and distinct.
Under the table, Benita felt the warmth of his leg against hers. What is a young man like you doing with a beautiful woman drinking by herself?
She found herself asking, her old sharp-tongued self returning.
In a moment, two other boys joined them, straight from work at a building site,
plaster dust on their jackets and under their fingernails.
And all of a sudden it was a party. More schnapps and beer and wursts with curry ketchup and crusty Brötchen. When was the last time food had tasted so good? The night grew cool, and when Benita shivered, the boy, the man, now that she was playing along,
gave her his jacket. It was warm and smelled of paint and sawdust, and beneath this, of him. It had been so long since she had been drunk. Franz had never drunk more than one, maybe two beers, which was like a thimble full of water for an ox. And it had never occurred to her to outdrink him. Before that, during the war, with the Russians and their stench of vodka, she had never wanted to touch the stuff. Now she was reminded of those early heady days of her romance with Connie, when he had filled her with champagne and berries, sekt and peach juice, and brandy Alexanders, delicious exotic drinks. She had the same lovely, clumsy feeling, a sort of numbness in her face and jerkiness to her vision.
Dear Connie,
she felt a swell of warmth for him. He had shown her a good time in the beginning.
Once,
he had presented her with a fox stole that wrapped around her shoulders with a glimmering, silky softness that made her feel like a movie star.
A woman everyone envied.
And Connie, confident, sleepy-eyed, with one arm draped around her, had enjoyed the attention as much as she did. In the middle of this reverie, Marianne appeared. She stood in the doorway of the grubby Biergarten, a homely shawl clutched around her shoulders, her eyes searching the crowd. For an instant, her eyes met Benita's, and a look of surprise, even shock, registered so transparently in them that Benita felt a corresponding jolt.
There was no joining these two worlds.
Marianne's ordered existence on one side, and these boys, this place, this buoyant, drunken feeling of irresponsibility on the other.
And so Benita looked away.
It was not so much a decision as an instinct. She threw her head back and extended her neck in a way she knew was loose and inviting. She laughed an indiscreet laugh. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Marianne hesitate as if considering whether to barge in. But she didn't, and a moment later she was gone. Benita was disappointed and relieved at once. The boy placed his hand on her knee, rubbing the fabric of her dress against her thigh in a way that made her skin feel rough. What did it matter? Benita rested her head against his shoulder. She was the slut and idiot Marianne had always thought she was. She was nothing but a stupid girl. The empty doorway where Marianne, her friend, her roommate, her co-parent, really, had stood, was like a black hole. Upstairs, in her room under the eaves, what happened was quick and unclear. Benita floated through it as if from above, the sweaty hands on her breasts and the boy's versed breath, the hot, surprising baby smoothness of his belly, the hard strength of his thighs. He was no expert. And more surprising, he had a false leg below his right knee, a hard stalk of wood that pressed against her shin through the pants he kept up around his knees. Did she imagine it? He reached down, but he pushed away her hand. And so she let him finish without knowing for sure. Only after he was asleep, with one arm thrown gratefully across her breasts, snoring slightly, did she verify. Gently pushing up the leg of his pants, she felt the smooth wooden shape of the false limb, and ran her hand to the end where it attached to his leg with primitive leather straps. A delicate nub of scar tissue covered the bone, dimpled and uneven, yet still smooth, as delicate as the head of a penis. She winced, and the boy stirred in his sleep. Benita sat beside him for a while, in the lamplight that shone through the window, beside his clumsy, damaged body. A war injury, probably, despite his youth. Maybe he had been one of those hapless boys ordered to the front when no one else was left. Shot on the spot if they so much as looked the wrong way. Or maybe he had been a cruel child soldier and performed some god-awful task. As quietly as she could, she gathered her things, the small bag she had packed, the shoes she had kicked off, the skirt she had dropped to the floor. Stepping carefully, she slipped into the hall and down the stairs, this time without question as to where she was going and with the cold, relieving calm of purpose. And when she shut the door of the inn, there was a satisfying finality to the click, severing her ties to this strange in-between life. Chapter 25 Berglinginfels, October 1950. Without Benita and the children, the flat in Tullingen was too quiet. No more Fritz scuffing the baseboards in the hallway. No more piles of shoes by the door. No more Martin lying on the sunlit parquet with his books. And no more scent of Benita's coffee in the morning or Eau de Gardenia perfume wafting from her bedroom at night. No more strains of sentimental music drifting down the hall from her precious Victrola. Though the player was still there. Theoretically, Marianne could have listened to a record. She herself had given the Victrola to Benita. But it wasn't in Marianne's nature to select an album, place it on the turntable, and play. Some innate self-consciousness, or even an inexplicable anxiety, held her back. One evening, she went to the shelf and hesitantly flipped through the collection of records. Almost all were unfamiliar names and faces, until she landed on Benny Goodman. She knew who he was, but when the needle touched the record, the notes that blared forth were startlingly loud, and by the time she had managed to adjust the volume, she was too jarred, too caught, really. A person mucking about in someone else's business, to want to hear more. Now there was only the light tap of her own house shoes as she walked through the flat. For dinner she ate a roll spread with jam or butter and a thin slice of ham. Instead of using the wide kitchen table, she ate at her desk. A grand, polished Biedermeier she had inherited from one of the Wanglingenfels cousins. She had moved it into the middle of the parlor, where she could look out the bay windows to the town square below and write letters to the children, one each night. The desk was her new home. And from behind it she threw herself into a fresh project. documenting a history of the German resistance. Every day she drafted plans, wrote lists, and took notes. She wrote to old friends and acquaintances, asking for journals and photographs, copies of their letters. She organized Albrecht's papers, but was too restless, too unsettled to actually read them. Benita had returned to the town where she was born, where Connie had discovered her. Beyond this, Marianne knew nothing about the place. She had written to Benita asking how she was and when she would be back, but received no response. Marianne's last image of the girl, sitting on the lap of some loutish Biergarten youth, was a horrible one. Alone in the flat with no one to distract her, Marianne was left to deliberate over Benita's departure. She had overstepped. She should not have gone to see Franz Müller. She had allowed her own sense of betrayal to influence her actions, and when she had tried to apologize, something in her apology fell short. In their letters from school, the children asked why Benita had moved. Only Martin was silent on the subject. So far, he had written two dutiful little letters detailing his life. Early morning chapel and cold showers and endless math. Obviously, he wrote to his mother, too. What did she tell him of her decision to return to Frühlinghausen, a place she had only ever spoken of with scorn? Marianne was afraid to ask. She began to compose another letter to Benita, one that sought to offer a more complete apology. But where to begin? Our flat feels empty without you. The flowers on the balcony have shriveled without your care, and when I noticed, I soused them, and now they look both shriveled and waterlogged, if that's possible. Herr Dressler asks after you every day when I walk past his flat. I owe you an apology, she wrote, and crossed it out. I was wrong to intervene in your plans to marry, and I am sorry, she wrote instead. If you would like, I will return to Herr Müller and apologize myself. I did what I thought was right, at the expense of your happiness. I see now that it was not my place. This did not sound right either. Too implicitly scolding. Too righteous. The truth was that Marianne had misunderstood their relationship. She had imagined Benita's affair with Franz to be a mere diversion, a flight of fancy. She had not grasped how fundamental it was to Benita's happiness. If she had known, then what? Should she have applauded the choice? An ex-Nazi for a resistor's wife? She could never celebrate this. But she had been wrong to interfere. This was what she needed to convey. But it was so hard to say both what was true and also what was required. At her desk in the lonely parlor, a thick, doldrummy feeling threatened to descend on Marianne. Through her friendship with Benita, she found herself dragged into the quagmire of complexity. Don't overcomplicate, she had always advised Albrecht. There is a right and a wrong in every situation, and it is our job to extract it. She stood abruptly and shook her head, capped the pen and folded the letter. She would finish it later. A warm breeze blew through the open window. It was an unseasonably warm fall day, the kind of day in which late field poppies bloomed and bees worked frantically to finish their work for the season. Years ago, she would have been preparing for the Countess's party, ordering wine and champagne, cakes and cuts of meat. The thought made her want to climb the hill to Berglingenfels. She had not visited the castle in ages, not since they had boarded it up. It was strange to climb the hill alone. No children running alongside her, gathering flowers, throwing stalks of wheat. No Benita trailing behind, stopping every so often to rest. But the sunshine and Herr Kellermann's new herd of cows grazing on the hill went a long way toward dispelling Marianne's loneliness. What shall we do with the castle? She asked Albrecht as she walked. Give it to the state, she imagined him saying. His voice unusually clear in her head. His answer was easy to guess. He was too much the aristocrat to suggest selling it. The very thought made her laugh. Albrecht von Lingenfels, intellectual, revolutionary, hero, yes, but a terrible businessman. And then there it was, squat, yellow and impervious. On this day, Marianne felt only pleasure at the castle's intransigence. It was like a steady friend. She quickened her pace. Here was the old linden. Here was her favorite patch of stone wall. Here was the footbridge, and the grand opening, like a wide, dark mouth. She tracked around the side to the smaller bridge that led to the kitchen, and stopped short. There were voices coming from within. Marianne could not make them out clearly, but one belonged to a woman, arguing. She froze and listened. It was Anya. Marianne's heart gave a contradictory flutter. Relief that it was her friend and not some intruder, and dismay at the awkwardness of having arrived in the middle of a dispute. Who was Anya arguing with? She had never heard the woman so much as raise her voice. Her tone was tense. Possibly she had come to check on the castle and been accosted by some dangerous vagrant holed up within its walls. They should have locked it up more thoroughly. Marianne stooped to grab a large stone and tried the door handle. It was unlocked. She threw it open, her heart racing. But the scene in front of her did not appear violent. At the table, a man sat before a bowl of soup. He was gaunt and hollow-eyed and obviously sick. Anya stood across the room, leaning against the old dry sink. A series of emotions crossed her friend's face. Shock, dismay, and then something like resignation. Marianne stood, still holding the stone, and gaped.
"I'm sorry," she began. "I didn't know."
The man looked from her to Anya and back again. With a frail hand, he pushed away the soup.
"This is your castle," he said to Marianne.
The words sounded strange. Berg Lingenfels was not really hers. He was a land surveyor, maybe, a tax auditor, a salesman of some sort. Her mind leapt toward possible explanations. Still, Anya did not speak.
"And Anya has not told you about me," he said,
dashing the possibilities. Marianne looked at her friend, whose face was now turned to the floor. Milk spread in two dark stains from her breasts. Marianne felt an overwhelming need to sit. From outside, she could hear the swallows. Inside, the room was dark and close as a crypt.
"I was going to," Anya said, finally lifting her eyes. "You must believe this."
Marianne stared at her. The face that stared back was unfamiliar, sagging with despair and a chilling sense of calm.
"This is my husband," Anya said.
When Marianne left the castle, the day outside was shockingly unchanged. The afternoon sun lay thick across the stubbled fields. The poppies bloomed. But she didn't see this. Her mind circled and darted like a bird whose nest has been destroyed. Her own actions in the castle were a jumble in her mind.
"He can't stay here," Marianne had said,
coldly regarding the man Anya had just referred to as her husband. Anya had bowed her head. Even in his sickly state, the man emanated cruelty. He narrowed his eyes and shrugged.
"Where would you have her take me? To her new husband's home? To some American hospital?"
They were more like threats than questions.
But maybe this was what Anya deserved?
She had lied to Marianne, to Karsten, to everyone in her life. She had thrived under their misconceptions, abused Marianne's generosity, and taken advantage of her desire to help. She had married a man under false pretenses, and now she had brought this stranger to die at Berg Lingenfels. For this, she should be exposed. But there was Karsten to consider. Surely the knowledge of his wife's deception would kill him. And he deserved better, even if she did not. He deserved to end his life in the upstanding and peaceful way in which he had lived it. And those poor boys, Anselm and Wolfgang, whom Marianne had never liked. Suddenly she felt compassion for them. They were harnessed to their mother's lies. So Marianne summoned her largest self and walked away. She left the man, this Rainer Brandt, whoever he was, to die in Berg Lingenfels. And she left Anya, who was not really Anya, who was in fact a liar and a false friend, a woman who had pretended to be something she wasn't, shackled to his death.
Whoever Anya really was. Marianne did not care to know. Let her rot with that man in the castle. The only thing Marianne could do was turn her back on them. Part 3 Chapter 26 Dortmund, January 11, 1923. One of Anya's earliest memories is of the day the French soldiers arrived in Dortmund. She is 12 years old, and her father has forbidden her to leave her room. But from outside she can hear the rumble of the troops. First the tanks, then the horses, then the African soldiers the French have brought from the colonies to help with the occupation. Frau Richter, the Fortsmann's cook and housekeeper, says they are bloodthirsty men, ready to spear and eat German children at a signal from their French overseers. She says the shortest of them is 9 feet tall, that they can breathe fire and throw flames, and will march half-naked across the continent, their heads bald as bladder balls. In comparison, the French soldiers will look like milkweeds. Seedy, slender little men with devious faces, here to make off with the first valiant sputters of output from post-war German industry. Anya is old enough to understand that Frau Richter is an irrational, superstitious woman with no education, but also that her husband and son died in the war, which they will all come to think of as the first war, but for now is still simply, optimistically, really, defined by a finite the. This loss grants Frau Richter a certain authority about all things military. The French are here to commandeer the coal factories that employ much of the city. It is the finest industry in all of Germany. Reparation is the bad word on every German's tongue. Just like in the schoolyard, Frau Richter says, rolling her eyes. We took their lunch money, now they must take ours. Last month, 8 men were arrested. Fancy men in top hats and tails, the owners of several local factories. For shame, Frau Richter said, looking at their picture in the paper. Is it not enough to take away their businesses? Do they also have to take their dignity? Most of what Anya understands about politics comes from Frau Richter. Anya's father, Herr Dr. Fortsmann, is a man of the old kind and believes children should be silent before their superiors. He is against politics in general, and longs for the restitution of the monarchy. They have seen nothing but rioting and inflation in the 5 years since Wilhelm II abdicated. And Anya knows not to mention the communists. Her father has not recovered from the shock of their brief takeover of Bavaria, which for a few weeks in 1919 became the Bavarian Soviet Republic. If he begins on the subject, no one will hear of anything else for days. For Dr. Fortsmann, all was better under the Kaiser, and he is the Kaiser of his own home. Because her father is a doctor, Anya's small family is able to live relatively well on a currency of traded goods. Eggs and potatoes in exchange for stitches, help stacking wood or cleaning gutters for treating a sick child. And there are always sick children because the local coal factory workers live in such poor conditions. Unlike the many locals relying on cash wages in a period of food shortages and inflation, the Fortsmanns are at least warm and well-fed. Frau Fortsmann has not left her bedroom since Anya's younger brother died. Back pain. Chest pain. Her delicate constitution. She does not venture beyond the confines of her sitting room. I speak to Anya, she says, when Anya brings the breakfast tray Frau Richter prepares each morning. She runs her hand through Anya's hair, and her eyes fill with tears. Anya can barely stand to look at her. Her breath smells of the chamomile tea she drinks, and underneath of something sour, the essence of inaction. Tell me what is happening, she asks. And Anya is nothing if not dutiful. Frau Richter has a new cozy for the kettle, knitted by her sister. Father read from Corinthians last night. In school, we studied fractions. Some men in Munich tried to kill the president. All news is equal. She has no idea what to tell her mother. No idea what she might be more interested to hear. Frau Fortsmann listens without really listening. She pats Anya's hand if she stands nearby, or smooths the soft skin with her thumb. For Anya, the act of recounting feels like vomiting. When she finishes, she immediately flees to the relative warmth of the kitchen and to more of Frau Richter's salacious talk of politics. On this day, when the French troops roll in to occupy the Ruhr, Anya has already visited her mother and completed her daily quota of embroidery. Frau Richter has gone out on errands and can certainly be found among the crowds gathered to watch the advancing troops. Herr Dr. Fortzmann is reading in his office, frowning over the latest news of German indignities. Only Anya is at loose ends, trapped in her room with the oppressively dark armoire, the stark painting of her paternal grandmother, and the tightly made bed she is not supposed to sit on. Out there in the world, not two blocks away, a conquering army is taking over her city. And here she is, locked in a chamber of relics, standing at the window and picking at the pills on her stockings. She has an idea, the most radically transgressive idea she has ever had in her life. She will climb out the window, across the roof of the kitchen, down the mirabelle tree, and into the garden. If someone catches her, she will certainly receive the beating that lurks behind all her father's commands, implicit in the switch that peeks out from behind his umbrella stand and his perpetual air of restrained violence. She would rather die than catch this beating, so she will make sure she is not caught. Anya crab crawls along the window ledge to the flat roof, a move so nimble she is surprised at her own ability. At the edge, she shimmies down the rough tree trunk and drops to the ground. From there, she dashes along the bushes at the far side of the garden and into the alley, and with a heaving chest, she looks around. She has done it. She has escaped. It is the first time she has ever disobeyed her father. The feeling is thrilling and sickening. Anya draws closer to Uhlanstrasse and hears the booming rumble of tanks receding. She has missed it, and the hard clip-clop of horses' hooves. But rounding the corner, she comes upon everyone. Here are the citizens of Dortmund, lined up on both sides of the street, watching restively. The French ride through the middle of the street on proud, high-stepping horses, bayonets poised on their shoulders like oversized needles. Underneath their helmets, though, they are disappointingly ordinary-looking. There are no 9-foot Africans, no fire-breathers or weasel-faced French overlords. But the soldiers' disregard for the crowd is an open insult. The air is thick with anger and hostility. Anya edges her way forward. She reaches the front line in time to witness a humiliating spectacle. One of the foot soldiers marching at the front of the battalion breaks formation to lunge toward a man in the crowd who has forgotten to remove his hat. The soldier knocks it to the ground. The man, who is young, stocky, and strong-looking, the kind of boy Frau Richter would call ein richtiger deutscher Bursche, a real German lad, attempts to fight back, striking at the soldier, but the people around him grab his arms. It sends a stir through the crowd, a collective intake of breath. Once the soldier has moved on, the people release the young man's arms, and Anya watches him scurry forward to retrieve his hat, now rolling dangerously close to a set of stamping hooves. As he darts before the great beast, he nods at the mounted soldier, a small, demeaning act of self-preservation. It is nothing in the grand scheme of things. They have just been through a war, after all. But at the time, Anya is shocked. The rough way the soldier swatted the hat from the man's head. It was as if he were an unruly child, or worse, an animal. It alters her understanding of what it means to be a German. This is a personal manifestation of defeat. This is what it means to be a member of a defeated nation. Anya's next transgression is more complicated. The Chancellor of Germany has encouraged citizens in the Ruhr to engage in acts of passive resistance against the occupiers. The girls' troops at the Munich gymnastics installation carry signs proclaiming, "We don't want to be your serfs." Workers at the steel and iron plants are on strike. In the south,
There are violent clashes between communists and right-wing Free Corps militias. Maybe Anya is influenced by all this protest. Or maybe she has simply reached the age of rebellion. On the first Sunday of Lent, Anya is supposed to accompany her father to visit her grandmother and aunt. It is a tradition, like most in the Fortzmann household, that Anya hates. Aunt Gudrun believes it is her singular responsibility to mold Anya into a proper young woman. Since her mother has decided to become a useless invalid, Gudrun teaches Anya to wash and scrub, and learn household responsibilities, and to sit absolutely straight and silent while the adults eat. So Anya is forced to perch on her aunt's horsehair sofa and nibble digestive biscuits while the adults eat slices of cream-topped gooseberry tart. The oppressive tick-tock of the clock, the sour air of the room, and the dry, shaggy bits of skin that hang from Großmutter's face all make Anya think, in an oppressive, suffocating way, of death. So, on this particular afternoon, when the time comes to leave for Gudrun's, she hides beneath the weeping willow in the back of the Fortzmann's garden. Its branches hang to the ground and provide a thick, leafy cover. The smooth patch of dirt here is one of Anya's favorite places. She loves the smell of the garden wall's decaying stucco, the damp ground, her own warm hands after playing with the twigs and leaves and worms. She hides things under the willow's branches. For instance, the cheap novel she found on a park bench that she knows her father would disapprove of. Too modern, too sensational. He believes in reading only the Bible and Schiller. Even Goethe is too liberal for him. Anya has also hidden the candy she pilfered from her class graduation party, a snake skeleton, and a colorful mosaic brooch she stole from her mother's dresser 3 months ago. Why is this willow here in the Fortzmann's orderly suburban garden? There is no pond, no stream, no river to quench its thirst. The tree is a leftover, someone told her once. Maybe Frau Richter, who is at heart a romantic, or her uncle Dirk, who is young and bad, and recently ran off to find work on a ship. The tree is left over from a time when the whole neighborhood was marshland. Dotted with ponds and sloughs and great water birds, its bent, grief-stricken shape is a product of its longing. While Anya lies under its grand draping branches, she feels that same longing. Her own cells thirst for the disappeared body of water. Her ears fill with the ghostly burble of an extinct stream. On this particular Sunday, Anya does not go into hiding alone. She is accompanied by her best friend and neighbor, Otto Schmelz. When she hears Frau Richter calling, she grabs his hand and squeezes it. "Shh," she whispers fiercely, and Otto's eyes widen in surprise. He is a little nymph-like boy. Thin and pale and dark-haired, and he and Anya often play for hours under the willow, making hospitals for sick animals. Sometimes Otto pretends to be a girl and lets Anya braid his shaggy hair. They carve games in the cool, smooth dirt, using pebbles as pieces. No one else on Langebeinstrasse plays with Otto Schmelz. For one thing, his father is not a doctor or a lawyer like the other men on the street. He is a shopkeeper who runs a small specialty goods shop in the city center. For another thing, the family is bohemian, at least compared to everyone else. And also they are Jewish, immigrants from Poland. Sometimes, when the weather is nice, his family plays music in the garden. Herr Schmelz has a fiddle and his wife a mouth harp. Their daughter, Susie, a wild girl with messy hair and an insolent expression, plays her accordion. It is considered unseemly. Like a carnival, according to Frau Richter, who would have a heart attack if she knew how much time Anya spent with little Otto. On warm summer evenings, Anya opens her bedroom window and listens as she lies alone in bed. This afternoon, Anya's rebellion makes Otto nervous. "When will you come out?" he whispers. "What if they don't leave without you? What will your father do when he finds you?" His questions nip at her high spirits. "Shut up," she hisses, suddenly aware of her own power in their friendship. She is a year older and taller,
and also in possession of a more intangible authority.
Be still, Anya.
Otto tugs at her sleeve and she shakes him off.
Shut up.
Anya clamps a hand over his mouth and watches an instinctive animal-like fear jump in his eyes. Reluctantly, he stays with her and does not call out. Later, when she is finally discovered by the policeman neighbor Frau Richter enlists to help with the search, Anya is both terrified and jubilant.
Why did you do this?
Dr. Fortzmann asks gravely, sitting in the big leather chair in his study.
You should know better.
He uses his deepest, most moral voice. The switch is propped against his chair.
He made me,
she says, squirming and looking down at the carpet.
Smelts, boy.
The policeman found Otto, too. But unlike Anya, he was dragged by the ear to the police station. She nods her head, thinking of the officer's expression.
It was his idea,
she says, and her heart races.
He wouldn't let me come out.
Something changes in Dr. Fortzmann's bearing. His hands spread over his knees and tighten slightly.
What do you mean by this?
Anya's story gathers steam.
He held on to me. He put a hand over my mouth when I wanted to call out.
Herr Fortzmann's brows lower.
You are not to play with him again. Do you understand?
Yes, she nods.
I understand. To Anya's surprise, the switch remains untouched. She is sent to her room without supper. And later that night, Frau Richter slips her a bowl of pea soup with a slice of ham.
Poor child,
the woman says, shaking her head, clucking her tongue against her teeth.
We should have guarded you against that boy.
It leaves Anya with a peculiar feeling, as if the lie is a physical object stuck in her gut. And though she is hungry, she can't eat. The night is beautiful. But there is no laughter or music from the Smelts house. Afterward, people throw stones through the Smelts family's windows. Someone paints a slash across their door. Word has gotten out. Otto does not return to school. In fact, Anya sees him again only once. He is walking across the park, his shoulders hunched against the cold, and she is surprised at how small he looks. It gives her a funny feeling, the way his dark hair flies up like feathers in the wind, and the thinness of his legs and short pants, like delicate twigs. So Anya tells herself the story she has concocted. He is a manipulative child who forced her to disobey her father and clamped his sweaty, dirty hand over her mouth. She imagines it so carefully that it feels real. Then one morning the Smelts family disappears. In the middle of the night, they load up their wagon from Herr Smelts's shop and leave their home for the Jewish neighborhood. On the long, boring afternoons at 34 Langebeinstrasse, in the days and years to follow, Anya misses her friend. And at night, she lies in her silent bedroom and attempts to recall the music his family used to play. It makes her heart ache. She knows it is her own fault the music has disappeared. Chapter 27 Dortmund, 1934. By the next time Anya runs away, Otto Smelts has faded to no more than a whisper in her childhood memories. This time she decides to leave home for a convent, the Sisters of the Holy Sacrament. She is now 23. A young woman, but under her father's roof, she is still a girl. She has finished high school with high marks and honors, but is not bound for university. Herr Dr. Fortzmann does not believe in higher education for girls. He believes it is Anya's duty to keep house for him now that her mother has died. One day she will marry and have babies, so what is the point of a higher degree? Anya, on the other hand, is not interested in housekeeping or marriage, or, for that matter, babies. She is an athletic girl with a quick, literal mind, accustomed to spending most of her time alone. In a crowd of girls, nothing about her stands out. She is of average height, has average blondish hair and ordinary features. Her eyes are maybe a little wide-set, her lips a little thin, her legs gangly. She doesn't care.
Her body is strong and healthy, and in her gymnastics troupe, she runs faster and hurls herself higher than any of the other girls. Her steadiness of character and good citizenship make her well-liked. She is always invited to the young people's dances at the Guild Hall. But she accepts the invitations only to be polite. What is the point of romance? It seems like a distraction from the important things in life, which are, in order, the wider world, not Germany, but the whole planet, full of all the odd varieties of human life. She has devoured every book in Herr Dr. Fortzmann's collection on foreign civilizations and anthropological research, science, and physical fitness. Or her membership to the local girls' sport training group, to be exact. So Anya leaves home for the convent not because she wants to be a nun, but because she wants to go to Africa. The convent has a mission there, in the former Habsburg colony of Namibia. She imagines herself teaching chubby native children how to read and boil their vegetables, and falling asleep under mosquito netting, listening to monkeys' cries. She hungers for an opportunity to see the wider world, and also to get out of Dortmund. Anya does not ask her father what he thinks of her idea. She knows what his answer will be. For all his criticism of the current state of government, the Nazis and the communists alike, Herr Dr. Fortzmann has never set foot outside Germany. It is his home, his Heimat, and in his opinion, the only truly civilized nation on earth. Since his wife's death, her father has become even more remote. At dinner, they eat in silence, listening to the clink of their own cutlery. It makes her miss the days when he lectured her about the sins of the communists, the glories of the Kaiser, and his favorite German heroes, Hermann, Karl der Große, and General Bismarck. Even his patients are deserting him. The Nazis have opened a new hospital on the other side of town that provides free care for the factory's workers. Herr Dr. Fortzmann locks himself in his study for whole afternoons, reading and scowling over the newspapers. Meanwhile, the world beyond Anya's stifled childhood home is blossoming. There is excitement in the air. It is a new day for Germany. The young Hitler, so handsome, so vibrant, and so unlike the tired old intellectuals who for the past 15 years have muddled the nation through riots, unemployment, and political strife, has been named Chancellor. The papers are full of his bold plans and ideas. He has the vision and energy to make Germany great. He has rounded up the communists who burned down the Reichstag and averted the revolution so many Germans have feared for years. Even Herr Dr. Fortzmann gives him credit for this. And Frau Richter is an ardent supporter.
Thank God for Herr Hitler, she says. He will save us from the Bolsheviks.
Under him, Germany is to be one nation rather than a collection of rivalrous factions sniping at one another in the face of defeat. Together, they will create the finest, strongest, and greatest civilization on earth. And Hitler says it is the young people who will accomplish this. It would be death to stay locked up in the Fortzmann house. On the day Anya leaves, Rainer Brandt waits for her on the corner. He is what? Her friend? Her beau? Her unlikely confidant? There is no label that quite covers their relationship. She has known him since they were children. They have attended the same school and church. They have waited in the same lines for bread, and gone to the same funerals, and played at the same carnival games. His father, a bricklayer at the hospital, is a patient of Dr. Fortzmann's. As children, she and Rainer played backgammon in her father's waiting room during old Herr Brandt's weekly appointments. "Last chance," Rainer says, pulling himself off the low wall he has been sitting on. "Instead of joining those religious zealots, you can run away with me."
"And go where?"
Anya asks, trying to keep her voice light, though actually she feels as though she might collapse. She has said goodbye to no one. Not her father, who would forbid her from leaving, or Frau Richter, who would cry and wring her hands. She is no longer a child, but she is still, effectively, running away. Rainer takes her suitcase from her hands.
I go to Africa when there are so many Germans who could use your help. Seriously.
They have debated this often. Rainer is a recent convert to the Nazi Party. He plans to be on the front lines of Hitler's wonderful new empire. He has already signed up to become a leader of the Landjahrlager, or camp, part of a national service program in which young people spend a year on the land, developing the necessary skills they will need if Germany is to return, under Hitler, to a great agrarian society. Soon it will be compulsory for all the country's youths. Rainer will be poised to rise in the program's ranks.
Anya sees the beauty in his dream, but all the same, she would like to go abroad.
She would like to travel farther than the German countryside. Africa beckons with its promise of lush jungles and primitive tribes.
Just think of what you will miss here,
Rainer continues.
It's the beginning of a whole new Germany.
Oh, Rainer,
Anya sighs, unable to think of anything but her father sleeping like an old man on his narrow bed. She peeked in through his door on her way out and was surprised by how rumpled he looked. Mouth open, snoring. His shirt loosened at the collar, his stockinged feet on the bedspread.
I've already chosen my path.
Rainer lifts his eyebrows. He has always been a quiet boy, cowed by his family's poverty, his father's poor health, and his mother's rough Swabian German. But now that he is a Nazi, he glows with an appealing newfound confidence. Girls have begun to take note. He is not handsome. His face is too angular and long, and there is something truculent about his chin. But he is compellingly intense. And he has eyes for no one but Anya, his childhood friend.
I give you 3 weeks in the convent, he says, kicking a stone down the street. You'll come around.
As it turns out, Anya lasts only 2. The nuns in the cloister are realists.
You will be sick most of the time, Sister Catherine tells her. The people don't speak German, so you must learn French. There are no potatoes. Everyone will want to touch your hair.
Anya could not care less. She is familiar with discomfort and sickness. She is genuinely curious about the natives. The problem for her is God.
You must keep him close to your heart always, says Sister Anne-Marie. If you don't, he will forsake you.
But when Anya tries to keep God close to her heart, she is filled not with warmth and reassurance, but with emptiness. Every night she says her prayers, and each morning she goes to chapel. She feels her habit rough against her elbows, the risers cold and hard against her knees. But she does not feel God. In his place, she feels dread and fear of death. And this worries her. She is an earnest girl. She takes the nun's admonitions seriously. She is Herr Dr. Fortzmann's daughter, after all. On her second Saturday in the convent, Rainer invites her to come see a presentation of a local Landjahrlager. The day is bright and lovely, and the air outside the convent walls seems to crackle with energy. A great many people have assembled outside the city hall, and unlike the cranky, embattled crowds she remembers from her youth, they are not here to fight or protest. They are here to celebrate. They want to capture a little corner of this new spirit of possibility and togetherness for themselves. And the presentation is marvelous. The 14- and 15-year-olds on the improvised stage look happy, healthy, and innocent in their matching short pants and thin dark neckties, their hair cut with a flop of bangs in front. They march in remarkable unison and sing spirited songs and traditional ballads, paeans to the beauty of nature and the joys of wandering. They enact a skit they have written themselves about the great German hero Hermann overthrowing the Romans. The costumes are basic, the lines are not particularly poetic, but the acting is committed and they have even worked in a few good jokes. When it is over, the actors stand straight and tall beside their leader, a handsome young man who can't be much older than Rainer. As he speaks about pride and self-control and discipline, and most of all, togetherness. Sons of steel workers and department store owners, fishermen and nobles, all brought together through a year spent living on the land. Behind him, five boys wave Hitler Youth flags with their single, elegant lightning streak. It is, possibly, the most beautiful thing Anya has ever seen. They close with a devotional song to Mother Germany. We are all connected under our flag of solidarity. Since we found ourselves as one people, no one is alone anymore. We are all obliged, God our leader, our blood, raised in our faith, happy in our work that everyone does. We all want to be as one, Germany. We are brightly standing by your side. We want this high alliance seen in all our glory.
Anya is surprised to find tears filling her eyes. She has not realized, until this moment, how isolated she has been. She has been alone every moment of her life. She goes to sleep alone and wakes alone. She has no siblings since her brother died, and no experience of a mother's touch. Nothing more than Frau Richter tisk-tisking about whether she has swallowed her spoonful of cod liver oil. And she imagined herself content in this solitude. Before today, she has always understood togetherness as factional. The rioting groups of her post-war youth, drawn together only because of whatever they were against. But she is against nothing, and neither are these young people on stage, who seem so sincerely lifted by one another's company. They are for something. For solidarity and Germany. This must be what Hitler means when he says Kraft durch Freude, strength through joy, strength through community and song and happiness. It is the opposite of everything Anya was raised to believe. The feeling she experiences at this realization can only be described as religious.
So, Raina says, after the youth march off stage,
she feels 1,000 kilometers from the nuns, the musty, damp-smelling cloister, the whole creaky missionary enterprise.
Yes, Anya says, breathless. You're right.
And so it is not as a conformist, but as a rebel, that Anya Fortzmann joins the Nazi party. Chapter 28 Dortmund, 1935. Anya and Rainer are married at City Hall. She wears a sensible blue suit, and he his best Landjahr leader uniform. The solemnity of the occasion strikes Anya as funny. She feels like a child playing at being a grown-up. But Rainer is serious as death. He remains two steps ahead of her as they climb the building steps. Even when she hurries, he won't quite allow her to catch up. Following this new, stiff and humorless Rainer, Anya feels the chill of doubt.
Do you love him?
Her friend and gymnastics partner Ulrika asked her when Anya told her they were engaged. The question took Anya by surprise. She and Rainer have known each other since they were children. They share a passion for the work and for improving Germany's future. And Rainer says he has always known he would marry her. His certainty is compelling. Anya is used to following the lead of opinionated men. But is she in love? She is not even sure what this means exactly. In novels, love seems to be a stormy and irrational thing, full of chaos and bodily urges. Anya has never experienced this, and it is not something she wants. What she wants is a partner. She is marrying Rainer because as a husband and wife, they can lead a lager together. They will be assigned their own troop of boys from all over the country. They will teach them how to till the land and grow vegetables and be proud, unpretentious, able-bodied citizens of the Reich. Never mind that neither she nor Rainer knows much of anything about farming. They have acquired some simple skills in their training and will work alongside local farmers. They will bring their passion for the movement and its ideals of togetherness, class equality, and national pride. When Rainer reaches the top step, he turns and offers Anya his hand.
My almost husband, she says,
smiling and panting slightly. He steps back and gestures for her to precede him. Together, they make their way down to the musty basement and the town clerk who handles such matters.
Their first two lagers are idyllic, really. They are the best years of Anya's life. She knows this is true, even much later when it is shameful to admit. Of course, in time she will never say the best years